This is my first year at Holden, and so I didn't know any better before I came. I had planned a 3-week series here, and of course everybody changes every week. So I've come to individual topics for certain days, which seems to be the better approach. This whole course is on renewal. And what does it say to the church's way of communication? If everything is changing, then how does our communication change? Now, we began the first week with a very critical approach, quoting what's wrong with the church. And I'm sorry, some of them left before we had any positive answers. Now we're getting into those a little bit, but I still believe that if you're allergic to criticism, you better leave, because this is not for people who think that everything is wonderful with the church and all we need is more of same. And I repeat, if this bothers you something awful, why, this just isn't a place for you. Because what we have here is extremely critical. Now, I happen to think we have to go through this because we love the church. It's been discovered by psychiatrists and educators, I think, without doubt, that the parents who love their children will correct them. It's only the parent who's unconcerned who says to his kid, "I don't care, let him do anything he wants to, let him use the car all night long." The parent who loves them will correct them. And I happen to believe if you really love your church, you'll be willing to listen to some of this extreme criticism in a day when the church is not only under fire, but is losing so rapidly that one great man, Thomas Altizer, from out east, has said without equivocation, the church is one generation from extinction, period. Now, that's pretty strong. How can he prove it? I don't know, simply by the reaction towards the church. Now, the first week, we read a lot of critical statements of the church. Just to give you a sample or two, one of them from Altizer already, another one, let's say, by Colin Williams, and all this discussion of the parish, is the parish dead, can we continue the way we have been? And a lot of people will say, but I like it this way. Which is one argument I hope you don't use on me, because it's the only one that sort of stirs me up. The rest I try to stay pretty calm. But you see, this argument, but I like it this way, I don't recall that Jesus or Peter or Paul ever used that. I don't think that Jesus said on the way to Jerusalem, "I do it because I like it this way." Or that Paul, when he was converted, said, "Well, I like that." It just isn't a very good rationale for church work. In fact, it's one of the worst ones. And so Colin Williams says the parish, as we know it, is popular precisely because it is irrelevant. That's why I like it, you see. And so if we have time yet this week, we'll get into the type of communication that's suggested today. And again, if you're allergic to this, they just throw out the proclamation, preaching. And they're not throwing out the gospel. They're just saying this is not the way to communicate today. And I don't enjoy saying this any more than you enjoy hearing it. But I'm living in 67. And if I want to live responsibly, I better try to work in 67. Now, again, people will say, but I like some of those sermons that I hear. And Williams would say, precisely, because they don't affect your life. That's why you like it. Now, at least I think we ought to listen, you see, and ask, well, what's the alternative? This is the hard part. Anybody can say today the church is weak and irrelevant and so on and so forth. What are the positive suggestions? And that's what we've been going into then last week. Now, we discussed last week this really renewed resurgence on the laity, much more than Luther ever imagined, I think, with his priesthood of believers. We went into the new morality and had planned to go on and got stuck in that because there was so much involvement. Now, I must ask you this morning how you want to go on. I'm here to help you. I can talk all day if you want me to, but one of the principles of the renewal movement exactly is, if it doesn't help, it isn't Christian. And I happen to agree with it. I don't always agree with everything that the renewal men are saying. And that's not really the point here either. That's why we've had no argument in this course, because it isn't what I believe. It's what these people are saying, you see. If you have an argument, you argue with them, not with me. My only concern is that we hear them. Oh, I could spend all morning with this. How we Christians have sinned by not listening. When Paul answered the Gnostics, he had first studied what they really said. I think this is why we're so weak towards the communists, because we don't know what they're saying. I've seen more seminary professors, Lutheran, this past year reading Karl Marx than anything else. Are they giving up their Bible? No. I think they're just trying to figure out, what are they saying so that I can talk to them? I've been spending my spare moments here, not very many of them, but reading a book by a French communist, Garabi, who knows Christianity from A to Z. It's beautiful, really it is. Here it doesn't say now Christians are way behind the time. He knows what Bultmann is saying. Beautiful. And here's a French communist of the first magnitude. If you went into a seminary library, you'd find magazine after magazine quoting Garrotti right now. Because he knows what the Christian gospel says and what Karl Marx has said, he maintains. If Catholics, he uses that in the same as Christians, try to deepen their faith, and if Marxists try to absorb into their vision of the world the dimensions of transcendence and subjectivity, I think they're possibilities of convergence. Isn't that beautiful? We'll get together, the communists and the Christians. Now, of course, we can say those dirty communists, and they get out their guns, and we get out our bombs, and we shoot each other, and change the genetic code of our children so that their children will be born cripples, all in the name of the Prince of Peace, if we want to. I just don't think it's in his name. Now, my point is here that we hear what these men are saying. We can this morning go on or discuss some more of the situation ethics. How many of you were here last week? There were several of you during the coffee hour asked that we go into this. Only two of you. Or we can, three, thank you. Or we can go on with what I would like to call the affirmation of creation, which really follows the situation ethics. Also this week, I hope to go into the God is Dead movement. What do they really say? I can, like Billy Graham, say, God isn't dead. I talked to him this morning. The college student would just laugh. How do I know you talked to him? Read after Auschwitz, where a Jewish rabbi studies what happened, or a Jewish rabbi and ends up saying, if Auschwitz is true, what I discovered here, then there can be no God. 6 million Jews, God's own people, tortured to death. How can there be a God, he says. Last page. Usually, you know, Jews, we say, well, they always believe in Yahweh. No. And this is what our young people are reading. You can pick it up in Seattle Airport, After Auschwitz by Rubinstein. Well, what's our answer? We can just outshout them, of course, and nobody listens. I'd like to go into the question this week of this whole area of ecumenism. Now, it's coming. We can fight it, but it's coming just as sure as anything. I'd like to go into that question and then ask, what do we as Lutherans have to contribute in this? Or if there's a Methodist here, what's unique? I just don't believe it when a Lutheran says today, we are saved by grace. You say that in an ecumenical meeting and they just about throw you out of the room. Because the Methodist says, well, that's exactly what we say. And the Presbyterian says, we've even put it in a new confession. That's more than you Lutherans have done. So you can't get by with it. To say we accept the Bible, or they do it too, of course. Now, do we have anything to contribute in it? Is there anything uniquely Lutheran today? If there is, we ought to contribute it. I think it's our responsibility. I ought to be myself and not try to be you. This is the way God has made me. Now, you be yourself. And together, we ought to help people. Now, is there anything uniquely Lutheran today? You've got to be honest. This is one of the basic principles of the renewal movement. You just don't throw sand into people's eyes. No, you got to be absolutely honest. Now, what would you like to go on with this morning? Do you want to go on? Do you want the situation ethics probably in preparation a little bit for the forum tonight? If anybody has any deep convictions, say them. I'm ready for either one. If you want to lecture on the Dead Sea Scrolls, don't ask me because I can't get it. But in this area, I am ready, and I hope it would be of some help, even though it's very disturbing. I found it that way, too. Now, do you have any wishes here that...
Let's have the situation ethics.
Do you mind? You were here last week. I think it might be of most help, and then we'll go on with this affirmation of creation next time, and we can even go a little bit more deeply than we did last time. I think... The very word situation ethics or new morality, which is equated, is exactly the same thing. The most popular book on situation ethics has as subtitle the new morality. And so if you talk about one, it's the same as the other. And the moment you use this phrase, usually somebody gets hot under the collar before you ever say anything else. Because this is sometimes about the only response we have to this thing called the new morality or situation ethic. Tonight in the forum over here, I want to quote a statement from this week's Christianity Today, which my brother-in-law brought me, which simply says, the new morality says you can do as you please. That's a lie. Because I'd like to find one quotation, and I have read considerably in this field as part of my course. I have challenged two groups in our master's program, mostly pastors. Will you find one statement? They had write term papers on this, so they read it on them. Will you find one statement of any one of these men who says you can do as you pretty please now? Outside of one or two hints in Hugh Hefner. And even Hugh Hefner would not be considered entirely in the area of new morality, though he has egged us on, let me tell you. I think Hugh Hefner will be something like John Dewey. Some of you remember John Dewey, the educator. Every church sent him to hell immediately. And now we're all copying him. Seminary, we added a whole year of internship because we believe in John Dewey. You'll learn by doing. Now, what is there in the situation ethics that might be of value? If we listen to them without first condemning them, then I think we ought to hear a few things from them that you and I have to answer somehow, simply because we're living today. You know, the old story, why do you climb the mountain? Because it's there. And why do you have to make a decision on new morality? Because it's there. And you simply can't talk to any young people today, especially in the college situation, unless you know what these people are saying. I think there are a few basic thrusts in this. Number one, that we ought to be aware of. I repeat, whether you accept it or not, it's up to you. Number one, it's certainly... stresses the rejection of all authority. Any type of authoritarian approach is out. Nobody says, I tell you to do this, because their answer will immediately be, and who gives you the right to tell me? I think Dr. Frost might agree with me that the other night I spoke here and said the most popular word today is relevant. I think the second most popular, at least in seminaries, among theological students, is something like, so what? So what? You can go on and explain all about some beautiful Bible verse, and some student will interrupt and say, so what? Who cares? What about all these people in Harlem? They wouldn't give a hoop about what you said. You try and tell this to the workers in Detroit, they'd walk off on you. So what? I had a Luther College grad who made it much stronger in the second last class that I had. And we were discussing what it means that Jesus preached with authority, you know. And one of the students got a little philosophical. Now, I'm very frank, this is renewal. I told you, you don't have to stay here. And a Luther College grad, Olaf Liddams, maybe you know him. And I can say it because 50 others heard him. He interrupted one of the students. Right in the middle of the class, seminary. He said, who in the hell cares about this? And nobody laughed. Nobody sensed. He was swearing. He was concerned. He was head of the coffee house where he tried to talk to these people every night. And who cares about this? We can go blithely on arguing whether one or two men wrote the book of Isaiah, you see. And you tell the people at the edge of the city that you finally decided that there was one author. You know what they would say. Now, since we are living in a day of rejection of authority, I didn't bring Harvey Cox's Secular City. I think develops it very beautifully. Now, this is simply the spirit of the times. You can fight it. That's all right with me. You may say the church ought to get busy and pound the pulpit again and say, listen, either or. I don't want to commit myself at this moment. But, Harvey, we don't do it politically. That the king says, we say, nuts to you, brother. If you don't do up there in Washington what we think you ought to do, we're going to vote you out. And there's whole rejection of authority, I think, even in the family circle. Now, I don't happen to chafe under it. Maybe you do. I'm sort of happy that things have changed without a father snapping his finger and all the kids stand at attention. No, I think there's a better approach. I really do. And now, situation ethics or new morality says you're not going to improve the morals, the ethics, the good works of a nation or of a church people simply by rules of authority. You know what has happened to Rome. A Catholic neighbor told me the more the priest shouts about how much you've got to give, he says, the less I give. My wife and I came home from a service recently and the pastor, they'd even forgotten to take up an offering. You know what happened? I probably would have put a dollar bill in the offering. I sort of came home and felt so good about that whole service, I wrote out a check. Much bigger. Much bigger. Because nobody had told me now, aren't you ashamed of yourself? With this affluent society, you've got to give, man. No. This is why I gave, because I wanted to. There's number two. An empirical approach to all problems. Empirical simply means practical. A functional approach. Quit your philosophizing, these men will say. If the two of you who were here last week will excuse me for repeating this, but I recall that at the seminary we discussed the question for an hour, if a young couple goes through a desert with a baby and they get lost, can they baptize the baby with sand? Oh, that was helpful, wasn't it? I imagine we've all been in the desert with little babies and wondered about that. Today the question would be, the young mother who was caught in the East Zone, you know, when the Russians divided East and West Berlin, there was a young mother caught over here. And her family on the west side, she was on the east side. The only way you can get over the line is either by getting sick or by becoming pregnant. So after a lot of prayer and agony, she decided to have herself impregnated by one of the German guards. When they discovered it, they sent her home. She was rejoined with her family. When the baby was born, the Lutheran pastor had a wonderful service. And they said this illegitimate little child is something almost like a Jesus. He reunited us, reconciled us. Right or wrong? Well, at least the question is real. Nobody worrying about going through a desert. This is the situation, ethicists would say, is probably the better of two decisions. I'll let you argue that yourself. Number three, and you have all kinds of illustrations like this. Number three, one of the basic tenets of situation ethics or of morality would be that all decisions are intensely personal. This was one of the hardest things for me to learn, and I must say one of the most satisfying and one of the most refreshing. Really, who was it? I had somebody say recently on the board of publication, "Man, you're so excited about religion, and you're always saying how you've changed. Won't you write a series of articles for the Standard, how you have changed?" Or I might should someday, because I think that's something like Paul after Damascus. There's this thing now, I think I know what Luther meant by the freedom of the Christian man, you see. That every decision is based very much on personal relationship. How does God come to us? God comes to us through personal relationships. That's the way he's passed on. He isn't passed on by a powerful sermon that I preach and so on. He comes, and this is the way Christ came. Now, I think we learned this from Martin Buber, you see. Here was a great Jewish philosopher who just died a year or two ago, who wrote his famous book called I, Thou. Or I think the other one, which is still better, Between Man and Man. And the main point being that human beings are important and that our relationships are important. You know, one of these days I'll drop over and then my relationships are gone. And all the things I found so exciting, you know, the children will throw away, maybe some old souvenir, but all my books and stuff, you know. What is important in life is the I-thou relationship. Now, Harvey Cox says you can't have very many of these. You know, you can't have a deep relationship with the mailman. This used to bother me. Well, now, maybe I ought to get acquainted with him. No, there may be only very few. And basically, this is the relationship to God. And since then, I think I've discovered a lot of this in Martin Luther, and as I listen to Bainton. Bainton hasn't mentioned it, but you know, Luther was once asked, and this is authentic, what's the most important word in the Bible? And he said, I think this is brilliantly Luther again. What would you have said? Predestination or Trinity or even God, you know, very theological. Luther said the most difficult word in the Bible is the word thy in I am the Lord, thy. God. Get it? This personal. We can all talk about God no end, as Paul Homer would say. We talk about him in Sunday school. This, I think, is a major criticism of Sunday school. We're always talking about God. And our students would say, who cares? Especially when you talk about Abraham. Why not talk about George Washington? No. Rather than talk about God, you talk either out of your faith or to God. You can put it either way now. And there's a world of difference, brother. I mean, most of my life I've talked about God. Well, classroom confirmation class by the hour. You know. So, there's just nothing particularly Christian about it. Anybody can talk about God without being a Christian, you know, without even propagating the Christian faith. The point is, do you or your students end up talking to God? You know, it's like a young fellow talks about his girl, that's all right, he wants to talk to her. Yeah, sure, why not? Finally, you get tired of this about. I want to go home to my wife, not just talk about her. And the same thing in religion. And I just can't listen to radio sermons that are all about something, about the Bible. It's all right if you like. I just can't stand it anymore. because he's hurting the cause. Do you mind one more repetition? It has helped me when one of the great theologians has said one of the biggest problems in the church is that we haven't learned that the greatest enemy of the best is the good. You think that through. You chew on that, will you? Oh, I feel guilty on this. We use an illustration that when I wanted to leave for this place and had to get my notes ready a little bit more, you know what the devil told me. He did not tell me, "Bill, why don't you go over to East Dubuque and get drunk?" He was pretty sure I wouldn't do that, even though I'm a German. He did not say to me, "Why don't you run away with a neighbor's wife?" Well, at my age, that ain't too much fun anymore. What did he say to me? The devil said to me, "Why don't you clean up your desk?" Now, that would have been a good thing to do. My wife would like it. It would be good for students to see a clean desk. But at that moment, it wasn't what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to get ready for lectures at Holden. The greatest enemy of the best is the good. It's my deep conviction that a lot of people read the Bible to run away from God. You see, as Tillich says so beautifully, the best place to hide from God is in a church building. And that's why T.S. Eliot, I think, says so beautifully, "Why don't we learn about the world, which is a God-haunted house? Go up there in the hills. God's there." I don't care whether you're carrying your Bible along now. But it's this intensely personal nature, and that's why I happen to believe a lot of people hate the renewal movement, because it's so hard. I don't want to be reminded of this. It's so much easier to read a chapter a day. So I read a chapter this morning, that's seldom. No, the situational ethicist would say that you just become aware of God's constant presence, that you're living in a God-haunted house. That's what it is. And no matter where you go into that house, God's there. And your decisions are made now in front of Him, you see. Oh, this is hard. Why don't you just let me read my Bible and go to church once a week, and then I do as I please, you see. Now, there is something to situation ethics, ladies and gentlemen, and I happen to believe that there's something tremendously valuable in it. Well, number four, and then there must be some time for questions for you. Number four, I think the fourth major tenet of this would be that your decision is made on basis of the situation. Now, it's called situation ethics. Why? Because these men maintain, this is one of the toughest, and I fought this, they're taking everything away from me. That your decision is made not by what Luther said, or maybe even Paul, because they spoke to the world of their day, when things were entirely different. And there is no commandment now that counts for all time. Thou shalt not kill. You are already practicing situation ethics. Because when your brother or son goes to Vietnam, the more he kills, the more he's honored. The situation makes it different. For me to hire some students to say, "I don't like my colleague, Dr. So-and-so, why don't you shoot him?" would be bad. But for the general to say, "Why don't you go over there to that demilitarized zone in Vietnam and you shoot him?" he can do it, and it's all right. The situation changes the whole business. One of my illustrations is marriage in Africa. Now, for me to have two wives, I think would be absolutely wrong. But in Tanzania, the Lutheran Church has decided that if a man is converted who has two wives, that he can keep them,
even after he's a Christian, because he didn't know any better. But his son cannot have two wives, because now he knows better. In Ethiopia, I went from one to the other, and in Ethiopia they decided if a man has two wives and becomes a Christian, he must get rid of one, put her in another hut, and support her. I think that's demonic. But they follow the rules. I don't believe that that's what Christ would require. I don't know. I shouldn't speak for him, I guess. But to me, this would be much more the situation which determines this now, you see. And it makes it so much more difficult for us, because in each situation we have to decide, all right, then what's left, what can you use in order to decide? If you don't have the authoritarian approach, the Pope can't say what you and I ought to do. In the first place, he doesn't even know how it feels to be where we are. How can he? He doesn't have any eternal principles. And let me say this yet before I throw this open to questions. I hope that before you reject this too easily, tell yourself how often the church has made a fool of itself. There was a time when church people said, don't buy life insurance, that's a lack of faith. Don't they look silly now? Silly? I remember the time when I went to a pastor's meeting, I was still a young fellow, but they argued about whether women ought to cut their hair short. Now, I can document the time when the Lutheran hours spent hours and hours against birth control. W.A. Meyer, you read it in his book, For Better, Not For Worse. Page after page, anybody who practices birth control is in hell already. You don't even wait. He's there already. You just look it up. Now, some of the money that I give Sunday morning goes to Lutheran World Federation, and some of that goes to Jordan, where the Lutheran World Federation men disseminate literature on birth control. How silly can we get? First, you're against it. A few years ago, the National Council of Churches published a document saying we ought to rethink the whole issue of abortion. And we said, communists, they're awful. Doesn't the Bible say? And now, my church body, the ELC, put out such a beautiful thing on abortion that the state of Colorado used it to formulate its new law in favor of certain types of abortion. How silly can we get? Now, this, I'm not trying to run down my church. What worries me, that this fine young lawyer in Seattle says, why should I join the church? They keep changing their mind all the time anyhow. And I really can't blame him much. Now, all I want to do yet is to plead with you before you throw this all out. I hope that at least you listen, lest 20 years from now somebody might remind you, saying, well, now, of course we've accepted it. Now, if it's wrong, then I think you and I ought to say it, but we ought to say it very clearly and document it. Now, I'm going to start. I got my own criticisms here and so on, but some of you might have some responses, some questions, some corrections, some additions. I'll be happy to have them now, if there are any. Because, yes, please.
Well, if in one part of the country something is right, and another part of the country something is wrong, the same law or the same Bible should fit in the same place, shouldn't it? Or could it? Oh, I'll throw out the example. For some people it's okay to have two wives, for some people it's okay to have one. And what the Bible says, that I believe,
yeah,
that you should have one.
It's all right.
But the church made the law that it's okay to have two. For some people, and only one to one. Not God to make the law.
That's a good point. That's a good point, which sort of reminds us that we always say theology is human. Now, some people would, you know, these are decisions we make. That's right. I think your other point, now the Bible applies everywhere. Is that the word you used? I think the Bible applies everywhere. This is what caused me such heartache. And yet already, you see, even in the Bible you have different interpretations. As Benton said last night, Abraham had a couple wives and wasn't criticized for it, because in that primitive situation it was different, you see. Now, let's take slavery. Augustine said slavery is a wonderful thing and is required by God. Not today, we say, of course not. But the situation has changed. Why didn't Jesus clean up slavery? He was surrounded by it. The situation evidently wasn't ready for it. Is that the way you'd put it? And so what applies in one period may not be applicable in the same way in the next. That's why this may help you. You don't have to accept it.
I mean, the same time.
Oh, who can help me with an illustration here? The same time. Well, like I said, Vietnam, this is the same time. Let's just take the world. Or even Vietnam itself. You shoot that guy over there, if you shot your own general, it'd be quite different. Now, it's same time, same place, and yet the situation requires a different decision. Yes, please.
Well, I think the key here is the personal approach, because two people in this room may be facing entirely different situations with the same basic facts presented here. So I think the fact something happened in California, something happened in New York, at the very same day, let's say whatever day this is, the 15th of August or something, doesn't really give you any criteria on which to make a decision. The personal approach. What is going on with that person there?
I don't mean the person. Let's take something out. That's in the church, something within the church right
now. Okay. That's what we're here for.
For example, masonry. The Missouri Senate would say it's wrong in one part of the country, but not in the other part of the country. And that goes from church to church.
Well, I think the situational ethicist would say here that you make your decision on basis of love. How can I help this person? Now, I happen to disagree with the Missouri Synod on this, and I have the feeling that if in Seattle you find a Mason, I would still try to love him into the kingdom the same way I would in Chicago.
I'm talking about the New Orleans masonry is okay in certain Missouri Synod churches. And I understand the synod is too neat. I haven't noticed which churches these are.
Yeah, okay. Maybe this the only thing the situation ethicist would say, you probably ought not make a rule for all times and all places. Now, you see, this is when you hear it said so often today, and then we think the church is giving up everything. It isn't. When you hear very fine church theologians or pastors or somebody say, now the Augsburg Confession was good, it is good, for 1530. But in 1967, there are problems of abortion, of birth control, all these, of revolution. Shall we start a revolution? We Christians in Cuba. Libya put a bomb under Hitler. Now, shall we do it here? These are all problems that are faced in 67. We need a new confession. Not because we've given up the old, but the situation has changed. And that's why the Presbyterians, I think, to be honored. Because they have a confession for 1967, they call it. Deliberately, lest somebody in 1990 say, oh, they said that in 60. No, they said that for that day. And I think this would help a little bit. It doesn't settle everything. I would disagree with the premise here. If it's wrong to join the Masonics in New Orleans, it's wrong in Seattle. But how to deal with people is the other problem.
Well, I wonder, what does the church itself, it's hard, the heart of people to make a decision. I personally, I don't think there's anything wrong with masonry.
Oh.
And I also can see where it could be wrong. I mean,
oh, brother, you're a good situation ethicist. You see, these men are saying the church ought not to make a rule. You make your decision before God. Well, the church ought not, then. The church ought not. Because the church can't decide in such things. Please.
In many situations, it seems to me that a decision has to be made within the particular frame of context of which the act takes place, so that what may be right in one, an act may be perfectly right in one situation because of the determining, because of the extenuating circumstances, and in another situation, the same decision which was right in this particular situation is absolutely wrong because the extenuating circumstances are such that it would not fulfill the specific ethical requirements.
All right, then how do you decide? The doctor who stands at the bed hears, "Oh, Grandma Meyer, 92 years old, shall he keep her alive and use up all the savings so that the kids, the grandchildren can't go to college?" Always look at the alternative. Or shall he let her die? Is he guilty of breaking the fifth command? So he must, at every expense, keep her alive.
Well, what do you mean by alive? Is a person being physically, biologically alive, or are there other factors that you determine that a person is alive?
Biologically, I would assume, is not you're in it. The point being that you have to keep her biologically alive. You're an MD. This is the point. Whether she can think straight or she probably can't. But you have to keep her alive. This is the question. And this is what you mean by biologically,
yes,
just to keep that heart of beating.
You're asking me whether we have to?
Yeah, that was his question.
Yes, under the circumstances where a person is vegetating, and is it morally right when it would incur hundreds of dollars of expense to keep this person when the person has lived a full life, say she's 70 or 80, and she's lived a full life, and now she's involved in an incurable disease in which she is vegetating, and the result of all these wonder drugs keeps her biologically alive, but in every other way she is already dead.
And $50 a day for her room. Now, yes.
Well, given the information you give me, I would make the decision and say that I would not have to keep her alive.
Now, that situation, that's it. Has he broken the fifth commandment, which is there forever since Mount Sinai? The situation ethics would say, God bless him. He's doing the much harder thing than to live by rules. Please.
Situation ethics, to me though, you know, people will throw a Bible verse at you and they'll say, well, for this ethic we should go by this verse in this chapter and do this. And we forget that the Bible is here to show us, quote, the plan of salvation. And anything beyond that is the situation, is how we interpret it. And if we get all fogged in some of these little things, we're going to miss the reason
we
had this book.
That's right. According to the rules, the adulteress should have been stoned. Jesus didn't. This question came up last week. Dr. Krausar asked it. On basis of what I had said, here's a man with leather and here are kids who have no shoes, am I allowed to steal it? He said, no. Well, what did Jesus say? David stole the bread off of the altar. And it was all right, because he was starving. A human being is more important than the bread on the altar. Yes, please.
They have allowed those with two wives to come into the church, but they have not left them to be leaders in the church. And in this respect, they are still abiding by the scriptures.
Yeah?
Well, I think, though, that this again proves or illustrates your point. I think, to some extent, the Bible, Paul, was writing to the first century Christians.
Mm-hmm.
and in particular ideas of this such and such. This is the situation, and I don't, I recall in mind the movie Hawaii, and I was completely, or quite a bit upset about this because I forget what his name was, but the minister who went to Hawaii to convert these people, and the queen was living with her brother, and this is terrible. And these people were very good, kind people, but this was just their way of doing things. But he wouldn't let her in the church because she wouldn't measure up to the strict letter of the law. And I felt that he was completely wrong in this. And I don't know, I just feel that with the situation, ethics is, if somebody's got something to offer, and they had two wives.
Let me ask you the question. Would you say that situation ethics is so much easier? This is always the point these men make. Am I way off? I just, what would you say? This is the easy way out, situation ethics.
It's
harder, absolutely, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I want your reaction.
With a very sincere thought, I mean, that you want to do the right thing. I mean, it's easy to follow the laws that are written down.
All right, so I do as I pretty please. The dean of women has all these pregnant girls in the dormitory, and they say, well, I wanted to do this. That's situation ethics. No, it isn't. Please, you, and then that's all we'd have time for, yeah. A little louder, please. What is the ultimate authority in situation ethics?
Yeah. And then we keep bringing authority back to the Bible. And I just was wondering, you know, there's a lot of people who completely reject this. You know, so I keep thinking that perhaps maybe we are wrong and completely trying to bring everything back to the Bible in situation ethics. And that's why I'm missing what's going on here. I think that's what's happening. So we keep going back there, for example. Like here, the Bible said, you can't have multiple wives if you're in the hierarchy of the church or something like that. So, therefore, and this is going back again to an ultimate authority.
Oh, I get you.
What they are actually rejecting something as an ultimate authority. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. Well, we might get into that tonight. That takes a little while, and our time is up.
Okay,
please.
With reference to people. Now, aren't people essentially isn't the nature of man essentially the same? For instance, way back, we'll say 2,000-3,000 years, man was essentially a selfish, self-centered individual. And that is the case today. All right. Now, I think the Bible lays down governing principles that hold true in a variety of situations. For instance, we'll take a political party. A political party that stands for, we'll say, the general principle. Those general principles might be true for the Republican and the Democratic Party. But from time to time, there are issues that change.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the same governing principles remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with reference to people, I think a child or an adult is essentially self-centered. And he's essentially selfish. He's looking out for himself. And that has been true more or less, I think, from the beginning of time. Now, his acts are governed pretty much around himself.
All right.
So there are principles that can serve as guidelines for a variety of different situations. And I think those principles are pretty much laid down in the Bible.
Okay. I think, do you mind if I add one thing? I think the situational ethicist might try to avoid the word principle and say relationship. There are, if you really love people, it isn't so much the principle, which is basic, but it's your relationship, and for Christians, it's a relationship with Christ and people, which would be the deciding factor. This might be one change. Yeah.
It seems to me, in the sense that a willingness to almost worship the Bible here And I think that our worship should be redirected towards the God of love, and then from this everything else flows.
If we could learn that, if we could learn that, that the Christian faith is a personal relationship and not faith in a Bible. It isn't. The Bible certainly helps me. It points me. I couldn't have it without the Bible. But when I hear a lot of these arguments about the Bible, it's like arguing about your front room. It's very important, but if she wants to change the furniture, oh man, that isn't the ultimate issue in life, you see. But we seem to argue about,
I think it's almost saying the same thing as she did, but I just was thinking, actually, the situation ethics is based completely on the two great commandments.
Right.
Love God, love your neighbor. And your situation ethics completely evolves around this one thing, these two things.
Knows that's the way Jesus quoted the law, you will remember. Well, I'm sorry, folks, but I don't want to interfere with the next man. And Thursday morning, I think, at 9:15, if the schedule holds, you know. I wasn't aware till breakfast that I'd be on at 8:15. If the schedule holds, I think we shall go on with this question of creation. When I sat there last night, more than 70-year-old man talking about sex for an hour, the president of the Lutheran World Federation going to every district this year talking about sex. What is this? Is the church falling apart? Getting weak? Or is it discovering something that we should have known through the years? And this certainly applies also to the whole area of science. Deep down, I felt sorry for geologists and scientists who always were given to believe they're second-rate citizens in the kingdom of God, especially when Rudy says the world is 3 3/10 billion years old. He ought to confess his sins every night, huh? Instead of rejoicing in the creation that he studies, and which includes human beings. And I'd like to go into that next time, if you care to.